All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 12 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We are working on understanding how we are connected to the ancient past. And we have established a strong link now to ancient Greece and Rome. We know that the founding fathers depended heavily on the example of Athens and Rome to develop the government of the United States. In fact, it is no exaggeration to say that the United States of America would not exist today if it were not for the lessons learned by the founding fathers from Greek and Roman history. Okay, so we have a strong connection, and that connection was hopefully reinforced for everybody here through the writing of the narrative that explains how we navigate back and forth. So let's cut the chat and let's get down to business here. So we talked about the connection, which let me now bring it back up for you guys on screen here. And here we go. All right, we have this, you know, now I think I'm going to stick with this whenever I can here. I think I'm going to stick with this wider context diagram for you guys at this level. Okay? And so, you know, I have another simpler version of this for students in the elementary class, and I'm kind of going back and forth in my head as to which one is the most useful for you guys. Ultimately, I'm pretty sure that you guys need and deserve this wider context diagram. So I am going to be putting it in front of you every once in a while, and we're going to use it today and tomorrow, and we'll return to it multiple times here. So just to make sure that everybody's okay with this, we have how many different colors on here is everybody familiar with and comfortable with? I would like to render this kind of automatic and comfortable for everybody so that we can just, you know, I can throw it up and you will immediately grasp it. So which how many colors do you know, Rosie?
I know all the ones to match armor.
Well, tell me specifically which color and what it stands for.
Manesnarma stands for Egypt.
Well, okay, but the color is purple. Okay, so purple stands for ancient Egypt. What else?
Gray stands for the ancient Athenians and the Romans.
Okay, ancient Greece and Rome. Good. Next.
And the fall of green stands for the fall of Rome.
Well, it doesn't stand for a milestone. As you can see, the fall of Rome is labeled in gray, and that is the end of the gray. So the milestones are connected to each of the trends. The trends are labeled in the colors. So what is the whole green set of lines?
The Dark Ages and the Renaissance?
Okay, but it's part of a certain civilization. Okay, this is really important to get. So what civilization is that that followed the ancient Greeks and the Romans?
The discovery of America.
Well, that was conducted by the civilization in question. Okay, so we got to get this down pat here. So, Nemo, what is it?
Europeans.
Okay, green is Europe. Okay, and then Nemo, continue. Europe. Blue is?
America!
Okay, so notice that America was green until 1776, right? Because it was part of a European empire. Okay, so this is going to be now something that we're going to see develop more and more. So I want to take it to the next diagram here, and that's going to be really significant. Okay, so blue, America. Green, Europe. Gray, Greece and Rome. Purple, Egypt. Okay, so now I need some help here. Why do I have other colors on here? The colors are of the major cultural blocks in the world. in some cases countries, in other cases groups of countries, related by a single culture. Okay, but they are the major cultural blocks in the world. So purple goes to brown. Why? And then one of the anchor facts of history. Theo?
That's Muslim culture, right?
Exactly. Islamic culture. Okay, so we're going to put this in eventually here, but I just want you to get the colors straight. Right? So Egypt is part of the Islamic world today. And that is one of the major cultural blocks. Okay? So what are the other major cultural blocks? Notice that these are not connected over here. What are these ones far off? This is saffron, the color of what civilization? Alexander?
I'm not really sure which one's yellow and which one's
orange, saffron. Huh?
It doesn't really matter. Anyway.
Well, saffron is a symbolic color, so it can help you, and it's part of the flag of the country in question.
I think the orange one is India.
You got it. Okay, orange
and
is India.
Other places around there, South Asia, but mostly just India because it's really good.
Okay, and then the yellow would be?
The yellow would be China and Japan and...
Yeah. Yeah, the China-centric world, right? So we have kind of the Indus River cultures or the Indian-related cultures of South Asia. All that's in orange. As you say, there's quite a few of them. And then the yellow would be the China-centric world of East Asia. So there would be that culture, okay? And then we have another culture that is quite young, begins over here, a little bit before 1000 AD, closely related to Europe, but distinctive enough that we want to mark it apart. Keen?
Russia.
Okay, good. So these are the main cultural blocks in the world. And we're going to see more of the green because you might be thinking, well, there's other parts of the world and how come they're not all marked on here? And the reasoning is very basic historical reasoning. It's that we don't, not all facts are created equal. Or at least, more correct would be to say not all facts are equally worth learning. And so one of the things that I'm very, very careful about, is structuring the learning process for you so that right now you only got to deal with these colors. Imagine if I put a diagram that had 13 colors on it. Then, that would start to get just to be psychedelic and confusing. So I want you to understand the main cultural blocks because this is going to help to highlight a crucial fact that we're going to be working on today, which has to do with the color, the colors have to do with the connections that exist in the past between us and the rest of the world. And most of those connections have been put in place by one civilization. And it is because of that civilization, indeed, that we are connected to ancient Egypt. Without the efforts of that civilization, we wouldn't. Without these, all of these lines, in fact, would still be, perhaps Russia would be connected. But basically the other lines would remain completely separate, and we would not have a globalized world. So we gotta kind of appreciate this. It's a part of how we are connected to the past. In fact, without it, we would not be connected to Mene's number. This just would not be a part of our story. We would teach ancient history and it would go back to here and we wouldn't have anything to do with this over here. Okay, but because of the influence of Europeans, we are going to be connected to ancient Egypt, and we have to then weigh the importance of that connection and decide how much of it we want to pursue and what it's worth. That becomes a kind of set of questions that we gotta answer for ourselves as people that do have a connection. Okay, so we're gonna be pursuing this. And I showed you this already. The connection kind of looks like this. This is the one way to illustrate that connection. Here in this diagram, any culture that still exists, I've got with thick lines. cultures that are extinct I have with thin lines. And then the thing to notice about this diagram, which we're going to learn more in detail today, is all of these crossing lines in green, which are the lines, you could think of them all of as the lines of globalization. There are so many of them that we could fill up the entire diagram with them, but that would not be particularly useful, right? We want to look for certain kinds of connections, certain dominant connections or fundamental ones, and so that's what we're going to be focusing on here. But the truth of the matter is, the green lines of connections are so many and so important that there is no other civilization in the world now that is not a hybrid with the green. In fact, to be quite honest, the blue needs to have a green line alongside of it as well. So I think I'm going to have to add that as I improve the diagram. Take me a while before I'm perfectly satisfied with it. So the green is everywhere. Another way to put that is history. I'm going to say this in a different way. It's not history. The past is Eurocentric. So I wonder if you get my meaning there. This is kind of an interesting point, so it's worth pausing for a moment before we leap into the talk today. Right, the world today is America-centric. Okay. And history, as I advise it be practiced, is present-centric, meaning we study it from the present in order to understand the present, which is where we live. So now I'm saying something else. So the world we live in is America-centric. History is present-centric. Now I'm saying the past is Eurocentric. Does anybody get the distinction? Why would I, instead of saying, notice that I said history is present-centric, properly speaking. The thing is, history can be done lots of different ways. It's not usually done present-centrically, but I advise that it be done present-centrically. So that's a method. That's a norm. But the fact is, and this is not a norm, the fact is, history is Eurocentric. The past, see, I'm slipping. The past is Eurocentric. What do you suppose that means? Abby?
That means that although history is present-centric because it focuses, or at least the way you like it to be taught is that it focuses on us here, but the past was Eurocentric because Europe was the center of the world in the past.
Pretty close. You're on the right track. Okay, so the difference between the past and history, right, is that history is the study of the past. Okay, so the past is the object, the thing that we are looking at. What kind of thing is it? Is an interesting question to ask. For so long, for human beings, that thing was actually many separate things. For instance, if I drew a line right here, this might take me a moment to do, so forgive me for the slight interruption in the diagram here. But if I drew this line, all right, if I drew a line right here, notice that, you know, for all that we know, which is actually true, that the China-centric civilizations here, the India-centric civilizations here, the Islamic civilizations here, Russia's here, Europe's here. Okay, and then, well, there's prehistoric America over here, but nothing to really note. Okay, but if we drew this line here, what would we kind of have to say about history and the way that it would be studied at that point? How would studying history back here, let's call it 1300, how would studying history back then be so completely different than studying it now? Timothy?
We wouldn't be studying the cultures that had the government, that had the ideas that gave us our government.
That's true. So the United States would not exist. Okay. But I'm talking about the whole thing. So I'm going to take this line and I'm going to move it over here because this is going to be permanent from now on. Because one thing that we need in our diagram is this thick black line over here that connects everything over here. So this is actually a fact, this black line over here, as opposed to this one is kind of just, okay, what if we were living here at the time? So maybe what I should do with that line is go like this, like that, there. Okay, so if we studied history at this point, here's my point. Maybe I'm overdoing it, but my point is this. We'd be studying China would be one story. India would be another story. The Islamic history would be another story. Russian history would be another story. And European history would be another story. So history would be what? It would be five separate stories, approximately, plus all the prehistory and all the other archaic stuff in the world. So there wouldn't even really be such a thing there's no way to make a single history because human beings had yet to actually become connected sufficiently to actually have a basis for making a single story. But things start to change, like especially right here. The biggest moment in terms of globalization occurs. And we get the age of discovery and they start to be connected. So once we get over to here, we have a world where everything is connected. And every other civilization is constantly bumping up against every other civilization. And there's a lot of friction and it's really tricky and everybody's got difficulty kind of figuring out what to do about it. And sometimes over here, you know, you get the bumping of the civilizations. I didn't want to move that one. I wanted to move the other one. Right over here, you get the civilizations bumping up against each other. It's called World War II. Right? And there's so much bumping and friction that it's really awful. Until, once again, you get worked things out and things get lined up in a different new way. And America is taking care of everything. So, anyway, I don't want to overdo this point because it might not be that useful for everybody here. But the point is, the past is Eurocentric means that the history of the world has become one because of Europe. That's it. That's what I mean by that. There's only one agency. There's only one culture that has acted, whose agency has produced basically the unification of all the world's cultures into a web, into a network, causing it to become a single story with multiple branches. But it's basically now one story. So the fact that history is one is because of Europe. So that's what I mean, that the past is Eurocentric. It's Europe that did that, whether you like it or not. And you will hear a lot of people out there who use the word Eurocentric as a smear. So if you're doing something, you know, like studying the Founding Fathers, or you're studying Columbus, or you're studying anything in history that's important, you'll find a really kind of perverse reaction to that. And people will say, oh, but that's just Eurocentric. And they're trying to make you feel bad. And if you get history, if you understand history, then all you can do is feel sorry for those people. Because what they are doing, when anybody, whether they're doing it on purpose or they've been duped into doing it, because a lot of people don't know any better and they feel like, oh, there's something wrong with Eurocentrism. But if they're doing it on purpose, and then somebody says to you, that's Eurocentric, what they are doing is complaining about reality. So, you know, you just have to feel sorry for them. Because reality is what it is. There's no choice about it. History happened. It is what it is. Get used to it. And you might not like it, and then there's something else about that is, of course, how you then deal with the facts and so on, and where you want to, how you want to proceed from then on. But anybody that basically accuses or uses the word Eurocentric concerning history as if it's some kind of negative thing, is basically complaining about reality. And you just have to basically feel sorry for them. Because you can't complain about reality. It is what it is, and it cannot be changed. And so you can ignore it, and you can evade it, and you can complain about it all you want, but it's not going anywhere. So the world we live in is Eurocentric, and the history, the past is Eurocentric. So today we're going to see a really crucial, important feature of that. And it is that we would not study Egyptian history today if it wasn't for Europeans. So that's one interesting fact. Anybody that complains about Eurocentrism really needs to get their facts straight, because we wouldn't know anything about ancient Egypt if it wasn't for Europeans. And it's so strange. In fact, we wouldn't know, here's another one, we wouldn't know any Indian history if it wasn't for Europeans. Indian history would be complete prehistory. There'd be nothing to study if it wasn't for Europeans. We wouldn't know any of the history of Mesopotamia or any of that either if it wasn't for Europeans. And the truth is, you know, the whole thing basically comes down to Europeans studying the past. So it's kind of such an amazing thing. We'll come back to this. But what we're going to study today is this green line here, which is going to be our portal and connection between us and Egypt. Without this green line, there's no connection, no reason to consider ancient Egypt. We just start studying Athens and Rome, basically, if we're interested in ancient history. So let's find out about it. It starts with this. Let's see here. It starts with this. Cool photograph. Lots of fun. So here's a young person. I don't know, it's probably a little bit younger than you guys. Egyptian youth, walking through a temple called Abu Simbel, one of the most spectacular in ancient Egypt, right? And he, like countless others before and since, have marveled at the creations of the ancient Egyptians. And, you know, here he is looking at this picture, like others before him, and he's probably wondering, what's going on? And we have all of this, you know, to work with, but how much can we get from the picture? How much can we get from the objects themselves without overcoming a certain barrier which just prevents us from really ever connecting to the Egyptians? So does anybody see what's going on down here? Abby, go ahead.
It looks to me like people are kneeling and cowering, but what's weird is it looks like there's some sort of person with multiple arms.
Yeah, so now this isn't an Indian god or anything. Sometimes you see multi-limbed Indian gods and things like that. But this is meant to be, because, you know, the ancient artists didn't exactly know how to do this. This is meant to be many people, you know, one behind the other, all collected together with their hands up in the air, right, writhing about here. Okay, Rosie, what did you want to add?
Looks like Mesnarmer.
It does, yeah. Good comparison. We will absolutely see that this is an icon of Egyptian art. This is something that became very much a repetitive use, kind of to symbolize the same thing. And the question is, well, what is going on here? Because if you're a young child and you're looking up at this image and you happen to you know, have a goofy history professor like Mr. Powell, he would say to you, well, how do you know that this guy doesn't have a really big spoonful of ice cream and he is, you know, feeding the masses? Rosie, go ahead.
Because no people would be having their arms up like that if there was ice cream and that doesn't even look like a spoon.
Oh, well, that's a cute answer. But how do you know? I mean, if he's saying to them, who wants ice cream? And then everybody says, me, 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 and they throw their hands up, right? Theo, go ahead.
Well, first of all, they look like they're cowering, and he looks like he's going to hit them, and plus...
No, but it's a spoonful of ice cream.
They make a store ice cream back then.
All right, you guys are nitpicking my funny case, which is just fine. But the point of my joke is this, right? I mean, yes, I'm overdoing it, right? But here we are trying to figure out what this symbolic scene is, right? And yes, nobody here is going to fall for the ice cream story if Mr. Powell promotes that theory on the internet and on Facebook. People have fallen for funnier stories than this, that the Egyptians invented ice cream and that the pharaohs fed everybody ice cream. So, but you guys aren't going to fall for that. But the problem is this. What is this? Now, you might say to me, well, it's somebody with a club. You might say, okay, this is a club. It's a strange-looking club. But you might say it's a club, and these are, you know, people, as you say, cowering. You're going to say that they are cowering, and so on and so forth. So what? Abby?
Well, it looks like what I see when I see this picture is a man who's threatening to hit these people.
Right. I understand that. Okay. So everybody gets that now. So I'm going to say this, though. So what? All right, you can go look at this nice, pretty picture. How are you going to get any connection to the ancient past from the pretty picture? Keen.
Well, the problem is we don't know. Like, we do not have the context to be able to understand this and make connections. We just don't.
Okay, and that context that you're talking about, the information that would permit us to interpret the image, is the answer to questions like what?
Well, what is this man doing?
Okay, how about even more fundamental than to what he is doing?
Who is he?
Who is this guy? How do we even know who this is? And what else, Rosie?
He looks like a pharaoh because of his hat.
Well, fair enough, but you don't know that. You don't know that pharaohs wore this. I mean, you do now, but you know why? Because of history. So you're cheating. Okay, because my point is this. How would you know that just from looking at this picture? You could not know that. You would not be able to identify who this is. And what else would you not be able to identify just from the artifacts, right, that you need absolutely in order to construct any sense of history pertaining to this object? What else do you need? There's another question we need an answer to. Theo?
Well, I think there needs to be written language so that someone...
Well, okay, but that gives us access to the answers to what questions?
Who this is, when this happened?
When this happened, right, exactly. I mean, how are we going to fit this in any picture of our understanding of the world if we don't know when it happened, where it happened, to whom, why, so what, and so on, right? And so we've got all we have here without, as Theo has, you know, gotten through to the, you know, the heart of the matter here, without any understanding of the written language of the Egyptians, all of those questions are off limits to us. All we have is a mystery. It's beautiful to look at. It's fascinating. We feel as though, oh yes, our ancient ancestors were amazing people, and they created these spectacular murals, and we wonder about them, but the problem is we get no answers. That's all we got, is we just wonder. Okay, because we don't have access to their written language. So that's the thing that is, you know, how are we going to know any Egyptian history if we can't read what they wrote? They did write. So all of this stuff here, if I zoom in a bit on it, You know, all of this stuff is writing. As, you know, people were quite aware that this was writing. The problem was they couldn't read it. So they couldn't decipher what the meaning of any of this content was. And, of course, what the sequence of the events was, and so on. So basically, Egypt was just one huge jumble. Until Europeans began to tackle that jumble. The Europeans first developed a science called archaeology. So it's kind of interesting to study this, especially in relation to our keyword from last time, right? We were talking about the archaic past, and the science of the archaic is archaeology, same root word. So Europeans began to develop the science of archaeology in the 18th century, and they were first interested in their own archaic cultures, their own archaic past. For instance, this is an archaic location in England, right? A construction by ancient Britons. As it turns out, it's the stones are aligned aligned with the stars in some pretty fascinating ways. And so archaeologists in combination with astronomers, in combination with other scientists, basically developed an interpretation of what it was that they were encountering. Similarly, archaeology is a science that has been used to work with evidence in relation to other cases, in relation to cases of material having to do with ancient Rome and ancient Greece. And in certain cases, archaeology is the best way to get the kind of information that we want. So I don't know if you recognize this particular rendering of the ruins of Pompeii. And, you know, what's the archaeology is so crucial to this. Because what happened to Pompeii? Hint, hint, in the background, Alexander.
Well, there was a volcano, and it blew up, and it buried everything. So everything was underground, but really well preserved.
There you go, exactly. This burying of ash, burying of the whole city in ash, basically all of a sudden froze that city in time. So if you could dig it up, you would find a civilization stuck in a moment of time. And all the artifacts that you could uncover, and even the skeletons and so on, you would find there, very well preserved, and you could learn an awful lot about what life was like there, because life never developed beyond that moment and that spot, right? So it's a completely frozen representation of the past. And so archaeology is concerned with such things in order to learn more about the people of that time. So, you know, you can uncover you can find the coins that would be preserved. You can find skeletons. You can find pottery. You can find all sorts of different things that reveal quite a lot about the life at the time. So Europeans were interested in the archaeology of ancient Rome, as well as their own ancient societies. And finally, they were interested in the archaeology of their own, of ancient Greece as well. Because we have the classical age of Greece, but prior to that, we have the archaic period in Greek history, which is very dubious in terms of its historiography. And in fact, some of it is so cloudy that it's not history. So hopefully everybody knows the story of the Trojan War. And if you don't, I'm not going to spoil it for you here, but you better go read about it. It's one of the most classic stories in the history of the world. And the story of this particular artifact has long fascinated people. And so there's a modern movie, if you want to resort to that, with Brad Pitt, which I actually liked. But on the other hand, I think it's good to read the stories of it beforehand so you can get a little bit of a context before. So, So the Europeans had developed the science of archaeology because they were aware of their own archaic past and were interested in it. But then that archaic past became something, well, they could do their own archaic past, but there was a reason why they couldn't do anybody else's archaic past. Let's go back here for a second. So, why couldn't the Europeans do the archaic past of Egypt? King?
Because I don't think they knew, they didn't understand their language either.
Yeah, that certainly was the barrier, but there was something even more fundamental to that, which is my hint here, about the green and the brown lines. Why was the archaic past of Egypt off limits? Timothy?
I think because they couldn't find a connection.
Yeah, but there's a reason why they couldn't find it. Theo?
Because they hadn't found those countries and stuff yet. They hadn't really globalized the world.
Yeah, all right, but there was a reason why. Who was in charge of Egypt? And not particularly interested in having European scientists crawling all over the place. Well, as it turns out, it's technically the Ottoman Empire, right? Okay, but this culture, Islamic culture, was completely separate from European culture. So Europe's got the archaeology, but there's no connection yet because these civilizations are, you know, not friendly towards each other. And the Islamic world doesn't want there to be a connection. And all of this back here has been forgotten. And in fact, nowadays, you can actually, in the Islamic world, you will hear quite a bit nowadays about how certain factions within Islamic culture are actively working to destroy ancient history. So the most notorious example of that is ISIS right now, this terrorist state which has arisen in the Middle East. You see it every once in a while on the news that they're destroying another temple. They're taking sledgehammers and they're destroying statues and destroying temples and they are deliberately doing that because to them, anything that is pre-Islamic is worthless. And so they're deliberately destroying it. And there have been calls in Egyptian culture to break down the pyramids, get rid of them. Because in Islamic Egypt, there is a significant segment of the population that says that all of that ancient stuff is fundamentally worthless because it's pre-Islamic. And so they want to get rid of it. And so the Islamic world was not interested in pre-Islamic history. And so, for the longest time, that archaeology in the West had no connection to this. There was just no way to build a bridge until this happened. Until we get to this moment in time here, and the moment is none other than this. Anybody recognize the main actor in this painting? the main character in this work of art? Theo?
Napoleon.
Napoleon, okay. And where is he?
He's in Egypt, attacking...
Okay, but he's in Egypt.
Egyptians.
Yeah, he's in Egypt, and he's at the pyramids. Okay, this is the Battle of the Pyramids, 1798, and Napoleon is conquering Egypt. Okay, all of a sudden, we're going to have a strong connection between Europe and Egypt. Because Europe is going to conquer Egypt, and Napoleon's going to be the first. And as you can see, he's pointing to the pyramids over here as part of his part of the battle. In fact, he called upon his soldiers to look at the pyramids and to imagine how the battle that they are fighting is as important to history as the ancient monuments that they can see in the distance. And so Napoleon is in Egypt. So now why is Napoleon in Egypt, and how does that bridge the modern world to us? Abby has a thought. I'm going to bring up a map to see. Go ahead, Abby. Not intentional. Okay. So here's the answer. Bring it up slowly. Anybody recognize what this is a map of? Theo?
So it's a map of the British Empire.
Map of the British Empire. Okay, very important. Napoleon was French. And throughout history, about how well did the French and the British get along? Alexander?
Not really well at all.
Okay. Okay, yes, thank you. So, the pink stuff is what the British had, including, oopsie, I didn't mean to draw a line. I wanted to draw a square. So, let's see if I can do that. So, including this stuff over here. So, here's Britain and Ireland, right? And the British Empire is going to extend to have this massive extent, including Canada, not including America, Australia, and places like that. Meanwhile, there's India over here. And, well, we have also, well, not currently part of the British Empire, but at the time, right, we have Egypt right here. So, Napoleon is from France, which is right here. Everybody knows their geography. Right? And so, yeah, so this map is from later on, but basically still useful. Napoleon comes here to Egypt and conquers it because he wants to go over here and conquer that, which is a possession of his enemy. Okay, so Napoleon is this French conqueror. Well, what is that? How can that be our connection? How can it be that this famous or infamous French general who conquers Egypt, how can that be our part of our connection to the ancient world? Well, Napoleon was not just a conqueror. Napoleon is definitely one of the most important individuals in all of history. And his agency is quite a mixed outcome for the world. And he did a lot of things, and some of them good and most of them bad, but some of them good. And so he was not just a conqueror. In fact, if we continue along this path here, this is a painting which, is in some ways, we're not going to do it in history through art. But it does capture a theme, which is useful enough for us to have here. And so we have Napoleon here, who's in the back of the tent, and he's got that characteristic kind of hat that he's known for wearing. But meanwhile, look at the scene around us. It's not a scene of conquest. The scene around Napoleon here, notice, here's a guy reading some papers and some other guys looking at a map or some other object. And then we got some pottery over here, right? And then we have somebody else with his sketchbook over here. And somebody who's actually making some sketches now over there, looking over his shoulder in that. And then we got this group of characters in the foreground, symbolically bringing an object up to this platform. Right? And so the whole point of this painting is to characterize Napoleon in a certain way. So hopefully you can recognize that this is a sarcophagus, right? Contains a mummy. And the whole point of this is that Napoleon brought scientists with him, archaeologists, scientists, historians, because he was fascinated by history. And he wanted to know more about Egypt. And it's because of him that we became connected to archaic Egypt. Without his conquest of Egypt, we wouldn't be. I mean, by by this time, we probably would have by some other agency. But it really is because of him that we became connected to it. And I know we're out of time here. But in order to just bring this story to a close here, and we're going to talk about this in detail tomorrow, what was discovered in Egypt by Napoleon's troops, in fact, and then preserved as a crucial artifact, was this particular object. And this object is, in concrete form, the connection. The reason why archaic Egypt is even worth any of our attention in modern times. Without this object, we still run up against a wall. We still have nothing that we can say for sure about ancient Egypt. But because of this object, we start to unlock the story. So tomorrow, what we're going to do is talk about this object, in particular the story of it, the background of it, the development of it, and everything. And one thing that you should have in your possession as well is this map. And so if you are in the junior high class, you have the geography assignments to work on. And hopefully you have done this already, because it's the week one geography assignment. And if you're in the high school level, I went ahead and posted this map to your class webpage. So you'll see it on the Lecture 12 resources, and you can print it out, and you can just have it in your possession, even though you don't have a geography component. So having possession of this map will help us to position what we're about to learn, because the object in question, as I'm sure most of you know already, is called the Rosetta Stone, and it was discovered in a location which in English is called Rosetta. And so we're going to figure out exactly how this connects us, and thus, you know, this will give us a new way to kind of think of this diagram. And so our Portland chart connection to ancient Egypt has to run through this line. This is the line. This is the connecting line. Because the past is Eurocentric. So then we connect up to ourselves because we're over here and everything is connected. But basically, without this green line, we are not connected to Menes Narmer. Okay, so we'll talk about that connection. So make sure you bring up the map or have your own personal filled-in map or print off the map from the webpage, and we'll be ready to make that solid connection tomorrow. All right, that's going to be it for today, folks. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye, Mr. Powell.